Welcome to Questions from the Audio Road. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford, and I'll be taking your calls and answering your questions for the next hour or so. Lisa is here with us, screening calls and keeping things light and fun. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in and ask your question. You can even bring us your opinion. It's up to you. This is your show. You can ask questions about fuel mileage, tires, engine, EGR, aerodynamics, truck specking, maintenance, taxes, financial planning, getting started as an owner-operator, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your calls. You know you'd rather talk to me anyway. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. We're going to jump right into the questions here in just a couple minutes. If you have a question, a comment, a topic, and you haven't pressed 1 on your phone, you can press it now. That'll put you in the queue, and Lisa will know to pick up the call. We have a lot of callers on the line tonight, so the sooner you press 1, the higher the odds that you'll be able to get through. Most nights we're not able to get to everybody's question, but we will do our best. Before we get to the calls, I have a couple things I want to talk about. Last week on the SiriusXM radio show, I took a call from somebody who wanted my opinion on a lease purchase program he was getting ready to sign. And I beat him up pretty bad because it was a horrible deal, and I could tell, this isn't my first rodeo, I could tell that he was already deciding that he was going to sign this. He wasn't really asking for my advice. He was asking for my approval. And I wouldn't give it to him because I thought it was a bad way to go. And then I posted the call, and we got a pretty good discussion going about it. And there were a lot of opinions on both sides. Most people said stay away from the lease purchase. A lot of people said, look, I did it, or I'm doing it, and it's working. Many of the people, though, that said they did it said they would never recommend it. They were in it, they were making the best of it, and they were going to succeed through sheer determination. And I love that. But they also said, most of them, they would not recommend going that way. Now, if you're in a lease purchase and it's working or not, don't take this personally. I'm not attacking everybody who's in a lease purchase. If you're in one and you like it, great. If you're in one and you don't like it, great. Doesn't matter to me. People call me and ask for my advice and opinion. And many times I will tell them not to do it. And many times I will tell people who are already in one to get out. It depends on the circumstance. But don't take it personally. I'm not criticizing your business model if that's what you're doing. I'm just giving advice to people who are asking for the advice. Now, speaking of advice, during that conversation on Facebook, I saw a post that I think is some of the worst advice I have seen in a long time. I'm going to read it to you. This is a comment about the discussion about the person that I told not to sign a lease purchase. It said, so, if you have bad credit, you should never try to get ahead, ? Just accept your position in life and stay there. Screw that. If lease purchase is the only way you can qualify to buy a truck, then do it. It's better to try and fail than never try. Never let someone tell you that you can't do it because you made a mistake in the past. The most successful people have failed more times than not, but keep swinging until they reach the fence. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. That is ignorant, horrible advice. What makes it worse is there are tiny little kernels of truth in there, that make people more likely to believe this garbage. Yes, the most successful people have failed many times. I'm one of them. I've failed at so many things, and that's okay. I hope I keep failing at things. That's how I learn. But you can't just say they succeeded because they stood there and kept swinging at the fence. That's just ignorant. This is the kind of garbage self-help motivation stuff that is screwing people over. You can't just say, well, I'm just going to be positive and I'm just going to be persistent. You can be positively stupid and persistently dumb. That's not going to get you anywhere. You've got to do something different, and you've got to try to do the right thing, not just something. You can stand there swinging at the fence for the rest of your life, but if there's a major league pitcher on the mound and you're swinging with a wiffle bat, you are never going to reach the fence, ever. And to say, just stand there and keep swinging, is just stupid. You've got to look at the situation. I gave the advice that there's no way they should spend $140,000 getting this lease truck. They should save their money and pay cash. They've made mistakes in the past with their credit and their money, and this is just going to be another big one if they keep doing it the way they plan on doing it. To just say, just keep trying. It's better to try and fail than never try. That's not true. It's not even close to being true. You know, I was watching one of my favorite TV shows is Shark Tank. I learn a lot about business when I watch that show. And the other night, there was somebody who came on the show and they had an idea and they had put a lot of work and a lot of money into this idea. But the idea wasn't working. And she was very, very persistent. She kept saying, but I have passion. I'm going to make this work. I am fully committed. Brilliant businessman said, everybody who comes in the Shark Tank is fully committed. They're passionate. It's not enough. You have to have a good idea, and you have to work that idea properly. So I just thought that was horrible advice, and I hear that kind of stuff all the time. All right, so let's get to some phone calls. Let's start off in Chicago tonight. Todd, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. What can I help you with?
I had a couple questions for you. First one was about super singles, in particular the 2-inch offset. You know, I read, you know, just for I'm trolling the internet, and all the comments, anybody who hates them doesn't have them, and anyone who has them doesn't see a problem with them. So I just caught a bit of a conversation where somebody was talking about flipping them around so they're nearly a zero offset, and there was some sort of a negative connotation there, and I know there's extra stress because the center bounce is farther out and everything, but I'm not really sure what's the big problem about it. I wondered if you could explain.
Yeah, so you're right. First off, when you get into conversations about wide singles, all the people who seem to hate them and have all these reasons why you shouldn't do it have never owned them. Sometimes there are company drivers who were forced to conceive notion, and they don't see the benefit. Hell, half the time company drivers aren't checking their tire pressure. I can tell you, one of the things I love about wide singles, it's so easy to check your tire pressure. That might seem like a simple thing, but I love that fact. The drivers don't care. They hardly ever check. The drivers don't care. The weight doesn't help them any, and the fuel mileage doesn't help them any. So they have a preconceived notion. They have all the myths that they've heard about traction and all these other things, and they just keep repeating the nonsense. When you talk to owner-operators who have them, the vast majority of them like them and wouldn't switch back. So you're absolutely right. The offset. The 2-inch offset is it's hard to say. Sometimes it works really well. Sometimes it doesn't. And it's really tough to predict. Flipping them around, I need to go do some more research on that. I keep meaning to. I just haven't dug deep enough into that to know whether that's really working out well or not. It sounds like it should. The zero offset always works. That's the good news. If we put the zero offset on, we're fine. Nobody's ever reported a problem to me as far as funny tire wear or wheel bearings getting hot or anything like that.
Okay. There's wheel bearings out there now, right, that are designed for that 2-inch offset? Like, is it the axle? It's not?
Yeah, it's not so much the wheel bearing, it's the axle. The spindle itself is lighter and will flex more because of the added stress put on it. So, like I said, I ran the lighter weight axles with 2-inch offset rims for years and never had a problem. And I know other people who do. But I do know lots of trucks where you put the 2-inch offset on and you get wheel bearings get hot and you get inside tire wear.
Okay, so I can only do one of these things at a time. My anticipation was, I put the super singles on, and I would like to do a lift axle with just a single drive axle with a liftable axle. Is there an axle you can buy that has a heavier gauge spindle?
Yes.
Or it doesn't even
exist? Okay. Yes, there's actually two different things that make the 2-inch offset ideal. There's a heavier axle, and it's also a little shorter. So the 2-inch sets you outboard where you want it to be. The problem is trying to figure out which axle is which. Over the phone, it's next to impossible for me to explain to somebody. So you've got to find a tire shop or somebody who knows.
Right. Well, I've been asked a couple axle guys, and there's a lot of people who don't know. Like, I'm just a truck driver who's doing research for my truck, and you start asking questions, and they just start flipping through books. They have no idea what you're talking about or that there was ever a problem or anything. And so it's,
you know why that is?
Why that?
Well, and I see this. I can point out so many places this happens. If you go into a dealer looking to buy a truck and start asking them to help you spec for fuel mileage, they're lost.
Right.
People who have been selling trucks for 30 years don't have a clue how to spec a truck right. You go into a tire shop and you ask them about out of round and checking radial or lateral runout. They look at you like you have three heads. shops do the same thing on so many issues. You ask a tire shop, guys who have been who have owned heavy truck tire shops for 30 years, don't know what rolling resistance is or where to find the numbers. The reason is, nobody has ever asked them before. They've never had to know those things because nobody ever cared. Well, now all of a sudden we have owner-operators who are educated who know that these things matter, and they're asking, and they can't find the answers.
Right. Yeah, and you feel a little lost because not only you're trying to spec the axle properly, but you're trying to make it fit as many components as you already own on your truck. And you're trying to explain this to somebody who's supposed to be the answer guy in that department, and, you know, he's just throwing numbers out like, oh, it's going to cost you $12,000 to do this changeover. And, you know, come on, it's not going to cost that kind of money, but you're supposed to be the expert, and I just don't want to spend the time to prove you wrong, because I'm probably not going to buy from you anyways because you don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly. It's frustrating.
Yes, it is. My other question was about your scan gauge. I heard you talk about it, and I'm sorry. I just don't know what does it do.
Okay. Have you seen a picture of the scan gauge?
Yes, I have.
Okay. So you know what it looks like. It's a digital display. It's simple. You mount it on your dash. It just sits there. A little bit of Velcro or however you want to mount it. You plug it into your ECM port. So it takes all of about a minute to install. With no tools.
Right.
And what it's doing is reading information out of the ECM. It can read almost anything in there. Now, we've programmed it to read some very specific things. The number one thing that we programmed this device for is to teach you how to drive to get better fuel economy all day long as conditions change. So it's an instant read fuel mileage gauge. Now, there are trucks that already have those, and there are some others on the market. but I looked at them all, and I've driven trucks with all the fuel mileage gauges, and they all suck. Because the idea is I want to see my instant fuel mileage so that I can change my driving habits. The problem I found was the instant read changed so fast and jumped all over the place that it wasn't helping me drive at all. So we played around with ours, and we found that the best time frame to track fuel mileage was on an 8-second rolling average. So instead of changing every 1 second, which was too fast to respond to, ours measures 8 seconds at a time and continues rolling. So every 1 second that drops off, you pick up another second, and it smooths it out just enough that you can start playing around with different shift points, different gears, different throttle, all kinds of things. And the average, and I was shocked by this number. We released the product last March at the Louisville Truck Show, and the average driver right now picks up a 0.5 mile per gallon within the first couple weeks of driving with this.
Oh, okay. So what are you watching? Like you're watching that instant readout and adjusting, kind of getting a feel for it and then making changes?
Yep, okay. And sometimes it's a matter of gears. Like people are driving around at, say, 60 miles an hour, and they don't know if they should be in 13th gear or 12th. And there's no way to know. I mean, we can look at boost and pyrometer and get an idea. But with this, you drive for a little while in 13th, you flip back to 12th, you watch what the fuel mileage does, you try 13th. And what you'll find is you'll tweak it, and you'll say, okay, 12th is working better. Later on in the day, the wind might die down, the road surface might be better, and you find 13th is better. So by being able to tweak all day long as conditions change, that's why people are picking up so much. A lot of people found out that when they were going up hills, they were getting 1 mile to the gallon going up hills. And by the time they got done tweaking with the scan gauge, 3 or 4 miles to the gallon going uphill. Which is, a huge increase.
Right on. Okay. Well,
so,
those are my two
and the
questions.
Other thing that, one other thing that we did, we took the fuel mileage numbers and we allowed, well, we converted them to real dollars and cents. So you can even, let's say that you know you're getting $1.78 a mile on this load. You just input that into the device. And if you just pay $3.82 for fuel, you put that in, then all day long while you're going down the road, you can watch your profit per mile after fuel.
Okay. Kind of an incentive to drive better as you see the dollars change.
It's an incentive because you see it in real dollars and cents all day long. You want to get in a hurry and you get a little impatient, and you watch your profit drop by 15 cents a mile, that's incentive to pay attention to how you're driving. It also reads every gauge that's in the ECM. I mean, I could go on and on about the other stuff, but that's the key factor that exists. Jason, welcome to the program.
Mr. Kevin, how are you doing tonight?
Doing good. What can I help you with?
Had a question. I'm getting a little closer to purchasing my own truck. I work in the oil field, and one of the trucks I see a lot out here, but I haven't ever really heard any feedback from you on, has been Mack. And kind of wanted to get your impressions a little bit on some of the Macks. The guys that run them out here, they really hammer on them, and they seem to be pretty good, but wanted to get your opinion on it.
Well, and like most things trucks, I do have an opinion. The 99 through 2003 Mack trucks were absolutely fantastic at fuel economy, and most people didn't know it. You know, I always brag about how well the 12.7 does, the 12.7 Detroit, fuel mileage, maintenance cost, all those things. But I think if we were to do a real head-to-head test, I think some of those Macs would beat the 12.7 Detroit for fuel mileage. I used to get calls all the time when I was doing accounting back then, and I'd look over people's records, and I'd call them thinking they lost fuel receipts. And I'd say, are you sure you didn't buy more fuel? Because I had Max back then, not modified, guys not really knowing what they were doing on fuel mileage, getting 7.5 all the time. And that's back when you had to work pretty hard to get 7.5. And some of them were approaching 8 at times. And I finally started to see that pattern and realized that a well-specced Mac was getting really good fuel economy. Now, the bad news is, in 04, when they went to EGR like everybody else, that fell through the floor. In fact, EGR seemed to hurt that engine worse than it did most other engines. We watched it go from the extreme of just about the best fuel economy out there to some of the worst. The 04, 05 started to drop down into the mid and high fives instead of mid to high sevens. So the Mac seemed to get really hit hard with the emissions on fuel mileage. Now, as far as emissions and breakdowns, like we know what the ISX is all about. We know the problem that the ACERTs have and the Detroits when it comes to emissions. There just aren't enough Mack trucks on the road that I've gotten a good feel for it. It's really hard to say. I get so few calls from people who have them.
I drove one for a year and a half in the oil field here, and the guys that I worked with, they seem to interchange the word truck and hammer and rock as being the same thing because they beat the hell out of them. And
well,
they
really are tough.
Held up well. And
yeah, there's no question about that. You know, Mack has a big background in vocational construction, off-road. They're typically not they fall way down the list on the over-the-road market. They've been a local vocational kind of truck, and they are tough. You give up a little luxury. You know, the doors don't close as solid. They're not quite as quiet, but they do stand up. Like I say, as far as the Max after EGR, I haven't seen anything that I'm all that impressed with. The older Max were very impressive. Let's go to Minnesota. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I'm getting ready to order a glider and was bouncing a couple different options around. The place I'm going to order it from gives me two engine options, and they're my favorite two engines, either the N14 or the 12.7 Detroit. I do heavy haul, and a lot of times I'm, you know, pushing 100,000 pounds gross weight. What would be the how does the 12.7 handle with that kind of weight? Because I know the N14 is a little bit torquier motor.
Yeah, if all we could do is put a factory motor in the truck, I would probably lean towards the N14, but we can modify it. So hands down, I would put the 12.7 in, and I would have a field day at Pittsburgh Power. I'd have the manifold, the turbo, and the power box at the very least, and then you won't have any issues with torque or horsepower. I mean, with the power box alone, you can approach well over 600 horsepower with that engine and all kinds of torque.
All right. Out of the box, what would be the fuel mileage difference between the two? I've always been a Cummins fan. That's why I'm kind of leaning towards the N14.
But yeah, I would say that if we do everything else the same, but you've got an N14 versus a 12.7, I would venture to say you're going to give up a half mile per gallon.
All right. And what kind, just realistically, what kind of fuel mileage could I expect doing heavy haul? Right now, I got an 07 International with an ISX. As many modifications I've put, I got the free flow muffler, the air tabs, the air filter, all that stuff. I'm averaging 5.8.
Yeah, we could. My goal, if you can do 5.8 with that 07, my goal would be 7. You know, and that's a stretch. We're going to have to work hard to get to 7, but it could be done.
All right. So, yeah, I'm looking forward. I'm hoping to order this soon. I've been talking to Jackie on a regular basis, getting her input on it. And the last question I had for you is the side skirts. Full skirts wouldn't do me no good because I've got to have my toolboxes for securement. But what about doing the half slip bearings over the tanks? Is that very beneficial, or is that kind of a wash?
If you're in an operation where you're likely to tear them up, then you're better off skipping them. The HEF fairings add about 2 to 3% in fuel economy. Not 2 or 3 tenths, 2 or 3%. So, you know, a tenth or a tenth and a half is about all we're able to squeeze out of them. And if you tear something up, you lose the savings pretty quick. So kind of a toss-up on that one. If you bought them and you never tore them up, well, then you're going to be money ahead. If you buy them and because of the operation you end up tearing them up and working on them all the time, then not so much.
All right, and one last question. As for if I can order, even get the 279 rears with it and the 13-speed, how will those – the only thing I'm concerned about that is with – I'm going to be 100,000 pounds tomorrow when I load. How will those 279s do with that much weight?
You know, if you had to come out of a steep dock with that kind of weight and 279s, you're going to struggle a little bit. You're going to work the clutch to get it out of there. And if that happens a lot, if you're heavy and coming out of, you know, deep docks, you might want to reconsider it. But I certainly, it wouldn't bother me. I mean, like I said, unless every day I had to pull out of a dock like that, then I might have a problem. But in a normal operation, even up to 100,000 pounds, the 279s will do just fine with a reasonably good driver. Yeah, you know, I wouldn't put a driver in a truck like that. I'd be afraid they'd tear up my driveline.
All right. That's all I had for you tonight, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. That's all I need. Let's go to Missouri. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. Hey, I called you asking you about if you have any regulations to where we could not run two drive tires on the front axle, and you said that you didn't know of any, and we discussed all that. Well, I got my son, we set up his truck and we tried it, and he wanted to move his fifth wheel back to where his fifth wheel was over his rear drives, you know, to help with the weight and everything. And so far what we found out about it is it'll work, don't have any problems, not tearing up tires or anything, but moving the fifth wheel back there didn't really help anything because we would go to a skill at our company and he put on 80,000 pounds, and even with that fifth wheel all the way back, it was like 17,000 on the rear axle and 17,000 on the front. So we're actually over the gross of the tires because the weight is only like 12,000. So we found really if you're going to do this kind of a thing, you're going to have to do it with a lift axle or at least be able to have the rear axle and the front axle to where you can adjust the pressure on the front axle to how much push is down on the ground. And that leads me into my question after you comment on that about my lift axle, because I have one on my truck now, but go ahead.
I've been asked that question about singling out axles before, and I'm never a fan of it. And I don't have any real reason why. I've just found the combination that works best is if you're going to do a lift axle, we like the wide single drive tire on the lift or on the drive axle and the wide single trailer tire on the lift. And that works well. Now, I think when you called, I've had that call a couple times with that question. I said, I don't know, so if somebody wants to try it, you can. But you're right, you would have to be in an operation where you don't get heavy, because you have limited your weight-carrying capacity by singling out that axle.
Well, I mean, if you add up the tire weights, you can carry 35,050 on all six tires, so you can actually carry the 34,000, you know, just as on an 80,000-pound max weight type of a thing. And that's why I came up with you'd have to have the adjustable air on the front. See, I did install my lift axle, and I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about that. Now, the way I did my lift axle, I took out the front differential, it's gone. I put a lift axle in there, 23,000-pound lift axle in the front. I extended my driveline all the way to the rear. I run 308s in my rear, and I took that one. It was almost new. It only had 100,000 miles on it, but I went ahead and did it. I removed it, and I put a locking back there so I can lock the two, which I I'll tell you, the first trip I went out, we got to Wyoming, and I was driving. I went to sleep. 2 hours later, my wife wakes me up. We're on a hill. I'm glad I opted for the locking because it got us going, no problem. But I also put a pressure gauge on the rear axle, and this is where my question's coming. I put a pressure gauge on the rear axle, and I have the adjustable in the cab on the front axle to where what I do, before my pressure gauge was set up to read all four tires or two axles, and if I got to 60 pounds PSI, I was at 34,000 on my drives. So now what I do is when I get loaded, I have the lift axle up. If I see it's going above 60 pounds, that's when I know to put the lift axle down, and then I usually adjust the pressure on that one down to 40 PSI and just to adjust the other. If I have to get above 40 on the lift axle, then I just keep, you know, going up until they're either both balanced at 60 or whatever. But go ahead, sorry.
Well, and if that works for you, that's a nice setup, really is. We look at the option of being able to play with the pressure on either axle and finally said, you know what, we need to keep this somewhat simple, and we decided to go with the either all the way up or all the way down, and when it was all the way down, we had an equalizing valve. But in your case, singling out that axle, that won't work. So I understand why you did it your way, and if it's working for you, great. In general, we didn't want all the complication of somebody screwing around with different axle weights. We just wanted an up and down. Switches up, axles up, switches down, axles down, everything's equalized. But, again, like I say, when you're doing this yourself, you get to play around with ideas, and it sounds like it's working for you, so it sounds like a good setup. Let's go to Texas. Jim, welcome to the program.
Did you say Jim?
Yes, it's your turn.
Oh, okay. Oh, hey, Kevin, how you doing?
Good.
I got a question. California, been struggling with it for the last 6 months now. You know, keep watching them raise the, short-term mileage from 500 to 1,000 miles in a year to let older trucks in. Do you think they're going to back down? I mean, do you think the economy is going to tank? Do you think there is actually a lot of guys out there that are not going to be able to go in anymore?
All right. So I try to stay away from predictions because I'm almost always wrong, but I'll comment on a couple of these. There are at least three lawsuits that I'm aware of currently against CARB for this specific rule. So there is a lot of pressure on them right now. Whether or not they're going to cave, I don't know. They're a bunch of screwy politicians, and I'm not even going to try to guess. It's the only question you ask me that I'm pretty confident of is, are there going to be a lot of guys who won't be able to go after January 1st? Yes. Lots and lots and lots of people are not going to be California compliant. Lots of people, I'm sure there are tons of trucks running around on the road today that go to California that don't even understand what the rules are. I'm sure.
Right.
So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of trucks that won't be compliant. Is the economy going to tank because of CARB? Is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're going to create such a vacuum for freight rates. I'm a Landstar flatbed driver, and we're, everybody's chopping. I mean, the guys that have got compliant trucks are chopping at the bit for the first of the year to come around.
Well, good.
Non-compliant trucks, which I am one who's going to wait till the very last minute. I mean, I've got an 06 Freightliner with a Detroit that's paid for, and everything else is paid for, and I really, I'm 58 years old. I don't really want to get into another set of truck payments for another couple of years. But, I mean, last month alone, I grossed $26,000 in California. Windmills out of Long Beach.
You're doing what I've been telling people to do. Just wait. There is too much up in the air. There's no reason to rush on this. They may extend it. They may put out some one of the ways you can get an exemption, you can get a six-month exemption just by telling California that you've ordered a DPF.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh, I didn't know
that. Or you can tell them that you've ordered a new truck. Either one, there's actually four conditions. You've ordered a DPF, you've ordered a new truck, you've applied for a grant to upgrade equipment, or maybe you've applied for a loan. I forget what the other one might be. But that gives you unless they've changed it again, they might have, but that was just a couple weeks ago. That would give you a six-month extension. And I'm telling people, wait as long as you can. Don't rush into this, especially if you have the ability to just say, hey, you know, I know there's some money to be made in California, but I'm going to sit on the sidelines for a while. I'm going to run everywhere else and just watch what happens. Now, what I hope happens, I hope the California-compliant trucks go in and get the freight and the rates go up and they're happy with it, and then that actually opens up freight in other parts of the country and the people who don't want to go won't have to. I don't think it's going, other than for California, I don't think it's going to be a big deal. I mean, it's easy enough to avoid. But for California, they may see some repercussions and some problems from this. I expect that. I'm not going to try to predict what they are. Let's go to Michigan. Nate, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I love the show.
Thank you.
Hey, got a question about the CMC. How much is that, and when is it going to be this year?
Well, you have got good timing because we just sat down. We knew we were going to have to raise the price of the CMC a little bit this year just because we've added so many events and speakers and our price needed to catch up. We actually just sat down and did it today. So the cash price for the five-day event is $1,300. The payment plan is $1,500. So you pay $100 a month for 15 months, or you pay $1,300 cash. So that's the price. The event is May, I want to say it's the 10th through the 14th. It's the May 5th through the 9th. Kansas City, same place we've been for the last 3 years now.
Okay.
4 years.
Okay. Okay. Now, I'm in business with my folks, and, my mom was asking me about it, and she's not really particularly interested in trucks, but she does all the books and stuff like that. Is that something she's going to, is she going to be bored if she goes to that, or...
Well, that's another good question. Here's one of the things we're working on. The way the event has always worked in the past is that everybody there attends the same sessions. Like, I might do the whole day of training on Monday and everybody sits through it. Then Tuesday, we might have Bruce Mallinson on engines and everybody sits through that. And then in the afternoon, we have Mike Beckett on tires. So everybody sat through the same thing. One of the things that we're exploring is setting the seminar up so that you could pick and choose. So Bruce might be talking about tires in one room, and I might be doing accounting in another room, and you would choose which one you go to.
Okay.
So that there's more flexibility, and you don't have to sit through the ones you don't want, and it allows us to. Now, that sounds good when you say it like that. Oh, yeah, I'd love to do that because now I can choose. Every time we've talked about this, we get a bunch of complaints that say, but I don't want to miss any of it. I don't want to have to choose between Bruce and accounting. And I get that, but there's only so many hours in 5 days, and we are totally full. We have no time left in 5 days. So the only way we can add more stuff is to make it so you have to pick and choose. We haven't finalized that yet, but that is the way we want to move.
Okay. Well, you want to hear no complaints from me because that seems like it's going to work in our setup. So,
Good. Well, we will keep moving in that direction. And speaking of moving, I have got to move along because we have got a lot of phone calls and we're running out of time. Let's go to South Carolina. Rick, welcome to the program.
Mr. Rutherford, good evening.
Hey, what's up today?
Can you hear me okay?
Sound great. Go ahead.
All right. Happy Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Birthday, all that good stuff. CMC.
Thank you.
CMC, looking forward to it. You know, I attended mine first about 3 years ago, I think, and it totally changed my life, and I'm don't plan on missing another one. So for that guy that's thinking about doing it, that's what you'd call a no-brainer.
I love that. Thank you.
Hey, Maxwell engine start module. My dealership has them for $790 out the door. Apparently that's
wow.
The cheapest price. Yeah, and they said next month they're actually going to probably go up to $1,100. But
yeah.
Anybody that's interested, Kenworth in McDonough, Georgia, ask for Shane. He'll take care of you.
I hope all of my listeners go snatch those up because that is a great price.
Oh, yeah. Even the Maxwell guy that was at the CMC, because I arranged all this while I was at CMC, he couldn't believe the price. He said that was the cheapest he's ever saw. And the one that I bought from my dealer was actually the first one they've ever sold, and they've had that thing in stock for over a year. So he ordered about four of them, so he should have them in stock if anybody's interested. $790 out the door.
Great deal.
And I went a step ahead, and I went to Bass Pro Shop, and I got a three-bank Pro Marine Charger, which they use to charge boat batteries. And along with my Maxwell charger, I hooked that up so if for any reason I should lose, you know, sitting around for 34 hours and using power, I just plug my charger up and it will charge your batteries from zero to fully charged in 4.5 hours. So that's a pretty good setup. That's the setup that I'm in right now is the Maxwell plus a Pro charger.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I have put the Maxwell to the test under pretty extreme conditions. Let it sit out in the cold for a month without touching it, truck fired right up. Let it sit out in the cold till my, and I still have some lead acid batteries in this truck. I don't even have deep cycles. I let it sit till all three lead acid batteries were down to about 7 volts. And I discharged the start module, so it was completely dead. I wanted to see what would happen under those conditions. So at the auto parts stores, they sell these little jump start modules, or usually the smaller ones will only start a car. But instead of needing to get another car and jumper cables, you carry this thing around, plug it to the batteries, and it'll jump start a car. Now, there's no way they'll jumpstart a truck with four lead acid batteries. The minute you connect it to four dead batteries, it just sucks all the juice out of that little handheld thing and you're toast. But it was absolutely amazing with the start module. Everything's completely dead. I plugged this little jumpstart module onto the Maxwell only, and in 15 seconds it's fully charged and the truck starts right up.
Yeah, I definitely believe you, man. I was in Chicago with that snowstorm that just passed, and the truck was actually off for 2 days with the wind chill and everything. It was, I think they said, like 15 below zero, and the truck sat for 2 days. I was using power, and I went to crank it up. I got synthetic oil, and this thing just cranked right up, better than it's ever cranked up before. So, yeah, that's a good product. I've got a few questions for you about end-of-year tax preparation.
Sure, go ahead.
Trying to lower my tax bill, maxing out my Roth, and if I put money into my HSA savings account, if I don't use that for medical purposes, am I going to get penalized if I use it for anything else?
Yes, you can't use it for anything else. It has to be used for medical. Now, the good news is just putting it in gives you the deduction. You don't have to spend it. but you can't spend it on anything else or you will be penalized.
Is there a maximum? I know this year the Roth is, I think, $5,500. Is there a max on the HSA contribution that can be deducted per year?
Yes, but I, without seeing your plan, I don't know what it is. It'll tell you in your plan, or you can call whoever administers your plan, and they should be able to tell you what your max contribution is. It's based on your deductible and a couple other things, but there is a maximum. Now, you do know that the Roth is not going to lower your tax bill at all.
Okay. You know, I always get those two confused, so it's the traditional that would lower my tax bill.
Yeah. Now, I like the Roth. I mean, I think that the Roth in the long term is the better deal. And here's why. When you put money into a traditional, you get the tax break now. So you will pay, that will lower your tax bill this year. Then that money starts earning money, and you won't pay tax on any of the earnings. But when we get to retirement and you start to take the money, everything, the Roth, on the other hand, you put the money in now, you get no tax break right now. You earn money, and that money doesn't get taxed. And when you go to take it out, nothing gets taxed. So in a traditional, every dollar will eventually be taxed. In a Roth, only the money you put in was taxed. All the money you earn will be tax-free. That's why the Roth is actually better. It just takes longer to get the advantage.
Okay. I was actually thinking about opening up a traditional also, but I'd probably do that next year. So no tax benefits from the Roth. I will get from my HSA contributions.
Yes.
Paying up my insurances,
yep,
up to the first – I'm sorry?
Yeah, well, I wanted to say one other thing. The good news is you can wait until when you're doing your tax return next year. And if you've got a really high tax bill and you want to knock it down some, you can open a traditional all the way up to April 15th, make your contribution, and still take the deduction for this year.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, that allows for a little bit of flexibility there. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, now the other things, pay off all your insurances, buy any supplies you think you're going to need in the first quarter. Stock up on
taxes?
Oil samples and filters.
How about taxes? Can I pay, do the safe harbor and pay up to the first quarter of next year like I did last year? Or
yes,
the same amount like I did last year?
Yep.
Okay. All right, good deal. That's all I got for you.
All right, good stuff. Let's keep rolling right through the calls here because we've got lots of them. Let's go to Arizona. Rusty, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I was wanting to know, I purchased a scan gauge from you guys, and I want my money back, man. I've only gotten 0.75 mph gain, so, but I want
it
back from my oil company. I want it back from my oil company, so how can I use this thing better to pick up that other 0.75 mph?
0.75 mph, huh? Well, that thing pays for itself in days.
Well, yeah, I mean, I run local pretty much, but, yeah, if I was running some bigger miles. But, yeah, it's paid off pretty quick.
Good. Good. I'd love to hear that. And that's an interesting thought. The reason you picked up so much is that you run local. You're going through the gears all the time. You're doing all kinds of driving, not just sitting out on the road, you know, at one speed on a level stretch for miles and miles and miles. So being able to have that instant feedback all day long in a local operation would be a big benefit.
Right. But there's a lot of information here that I've gotten back from ScanGauge themselves. I guess there's some additional codes and stuff like that. What do I do with that information? How do I enter it in? How do I use this thing better to get, you know, its full benefit?
There are instructions for what they call their X code. But I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll put you in touch with Jeff Zarley. Jeff is our technical director on the scan gauge, and he will be able to walk you right through the X code, which is very cool, and it's much easier than it looks. It sounds complicated, but Jeff will walk you right through it. You can also go to YouTube and do a Google search for a YouTube search for ScanGauge KR. You'll find some of the videos that we've done. There is also a Facebook page. Do a Facebook search for ScanGauge KR. We have a group, and you can join the group, and there's tons of great information and lots of people who are willing to share with you as well. Let's go to Kentucky. Rusty, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin.
What can I help you with tonight?
We're looking at a new truck, and the Cascadia with the 144-inch sleeper, and it comes with the 12-speed auto shift and 331, the DT15. What is that for specs?
Do you happen to know what the final ratio is on that 12-speed?
No, I don't.
I'm going to guess, since they matched it with 331s, is that what it says?
Yep, that's what it said. I hadn't heard of that one either.
They have some funky new gear ratios coming out. You know, it's kind of frustrating because I used to be able to tell you Eaton, Meritor, Rockwell, right up the line, what all their ratios were, and now everybody's got all kinds of funky new ratios, so I got to learn some new ones. I'm going to guess that 12-speed is a double overdrive with a 0.74. I wouldn't like it. I know that they say that engine pulls down really low in RPM, and it does. I still think that's too tall of a gear, unless you're going to drive 65 or faster all the time. If you are,
yeah,
then it's a perfect gear.
Okay,
yeah, if you're
going to
run 65,
drive.
Okay, then that's a perfect gear. Those are good specs.
They're good specs. Okay, I was wondering, right now we have our glider, which we love, and we put the 264s in it, which are even better.
I was wondering about changing over that. You could do that, and I still like that better. I like the you would drive in direct, which on that transmission is probably 10th. And since you've already played around with 264s and you like them, you get it. If you wanted to match those 336s, you could actually go with a 250 gear ratio. I think the 264 would be okay. In fact, I would probably choose the 264, but you could go to a 250, which would be almost identical in 10th gear as those 331s in 12.
Okay. Yeah, because I know, like, right now the 264s are actually probably a little bit higher than what I needed. I probably should have went with 27. Well, actually, it was a 281 or something. Like, it was, for this rear end, it was
okay.
A different ratio. But,
right.
Because, like, with this one, your 1400 is 70 at 72 miles an hour at 12th gear, which running like we do around 70 all the time is fine. We're getting 7.11 for a 90-day average, so I can't complain on that one.
If you wanted to run 70 miles an hour in direct, then I would actually spec 250s instead of the 264s, and that is an available gear ratio now. Let's go to Maryland. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Great show. Love it. The reason I'm actually calling, I bought a ScanGauge about probably 4 months ago, maybe more, and I haven't been able to use it. You know, the AVG and the MPG was all over the board. So I talked to Jeff. I talked to other people from Arizona. You know, I thought the ScanGauge was the issue. But I got to figure out, you know.
Oh, good.
Because my brother tried it for a few months. He worked fine on his truck. And now I realize that I had the EGR unplugged on the ISX. It was making the fuel. He couldn't read the fuel, you know, to keep it the way it was supposed to. It was all over the board, you know. So that EGR back in, and it checked the way it should, you know. I went across Pennsylvania today, 80,000 pounds. 7.7 miles a gallon on a 10 gauge.
Good. I'm glad you got it figured out.
Yeah, I got the Super Singles about 7,000 miles ago. I got a, how you call it, PSI and a temperature read for the tires, you know, to keep an eye on them. And
right.
When you see how the temperature affects the pressure, it's amazing. 20, 25 PSI, you know, it goes up from what it was inflated. You know, cold.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it'll change all over the board with temperature.
Yes.
Now, the one thing I try to do, though, I try to keep it very consistent, meaning once I choose my pressure, then I always try to keep it at that pressure cold in the morning. And that does mean you're going to be changing your tire pressure more often, but that seems to work well. And the other thing is, normally, if you start off the day at 0 degrees, or 10 or 20 degrees, the odds that you're ever going to get to 80 in that day are pretty slim. I know it can happen. I know there's some extremes. But everybody I've talked to about tires says you always don't try to – how do I want to say this so it's clear? Don't try to second-guess and modify your pressure based on the temperature. Just pick your pressure, whether it's 100, 110, 115, whatever you're happy with, and always set it to that pressure cold in the morning. Say, and that will be more consistent than any other way that you can do it. Let's squeeze another call or two in before we've got to get out of here. Let's go to Virginia. Tim, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, thank you for taking time, spending time with all of us on the radio. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. What can I help you with?
Calling about fuel mileage. My question is, I talked to you before. I never got a chance to order the skin gauge. My friend is really pissed off at me because he let me onto your show, and he's just like, spend the $200, spend the $200. And I'm like, I will when I get a chance. But I was doing 60, and I dropped down to 55. I got a 13 speed. I would like to know if you would be able to possibly tell me if I should be in 13th or in 12th. Like right now I'm doing 55, bobtailing, and 13th RPMs right at 12.
What engine and what year?
2007, of course, Acer Cat.
Okay. So most of the time, you're going to be better off in 12. At 55. Usually 55 to 60, 12th gear is going to work better with that Acer. Above 60, you're probably going to want to 60 to 62 or 3 is kind of the gray area. Above 63, you'll almost always want to be in 13th. But this is where the scan gauge will really shine. Because right now, bobtailing, you're probably better off in 13th. But if you put weight in there, or we're climbing hills, or we have any winds, or rougher road conditions, then 12th is going to work out. That's why the scan gauge is so valuable, because it tells us all the time. I am all out of time. I want to thank everybody. I know we didn't get to a lot of the calls, but... I really want to thank you for joining us on the podcast. We are going to try to grow the podcast and add more hours. It's tough right now with our schedule. We are committed to doing at least 1 hour of podcast. We have a lot of demand and a lot of questions, so we're going to try to grow that over time. So if we can get to your question, I apologize, and next week, try to dial in a little sooner and hit one quick, and because we take the calls in order that they came in and pressed one. So, again, thanks, everybody. We will see you tonight for the live show. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Good night, everyone.